From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. The suicide rate in America has been inching up during the last decade. What if a simple blood test could help us figure out who is at greatest risk of suicide? We talk with a Johns Hopkins scientist looking at just that. Then George Collins, former editor-in-chief of Baltimore's Afro-American newspaper and a WMAR broadcaster, died last week at age 88. We talk about Collins' work documenting the civil rights movement in Maryland with his colleague, Charles Robinson of Maryland Public Television. Plus, writer Paul Valentine's latest novel follows a newspaper man as he digs for truths buried in the past of a small southern town in 1970. The former Washington Post reporter tells Tom Hall about the road to Goshen Shoals. First, the news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Our country loses tens of thousands of people to suicide every year. Some of them, no doubt, showed suicidal signs, others less so. What if there was a simple blood test that could predict who is at a higher risk of suicide? Researchers at Johns Hopkins are looking at how to do just that. And with me to talk about it is Zachary Kaminsky, Ph.D. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins Medicine. He's also the lead researcher on a study published last week that posits a possible blood test for suicide risk. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Sheila.
So tell me how this test would work.
Well, essentially, what we would do would be to measure a new type of molecular mark that we believe we've identified in a gene that seems to be associated with suicide. So cutting to the chase for a blood test, as it were, it's essentially that we've identified an elevated level of this chemical modification for a particular gene called SCA2. So for trying to predict suicide, what we would be doing is to be looking for this elevated level in the blood from individuals that we would take. And we would put this into our various statistical models to try to generate an estimate of risk.
Let me back up. Gene associated with suicide. Was it already known that there is a gene associated with suicide?
No. So we really started this study from scratch, and we were looking for these sorts of molecular marks. Essentially, these marks are on the DNA connected to genes that act like light switches. It might be better to think of them like dimmer switches because they can turn up or down the levels of a particular gene protein that's made. Now, a gene protein is like the machine of the cell, but the DNA is the blueprint. So the question is, when you've got this blueprint, how much of this gene is going to be made? And so we were studying these molecular marks, and we were asking the question, are any of these genes, any genes at all, turned off in suicide when they shouldn't be? So the way we did that was to use a technology that allowed us to really take a snapshot of the entire genome, all the genes at once, and ask, is anything different? And we did this in postmortem brain tissue from individuals who had died by suicide compared to those who hadn't. And this one gene, this SCA2 gene, really came to the top.
SKA2. It came to the top in the sense that you saw that there was more of it in people who had taken their own lives?
Yeah, this dimmer switch looked to be turned off, as it were. So we followed this, and then what we did was to look for the levels of gene expression for SCA2 also in the brain samples, and we found that they were much lower. So it did look like levels of SCA2 were much lower in individuals who had died by suicide.
So when you say the dimmer switch was turned off, it was not holding down a stress chemical? It was allowing that stress chemical to be produced in great amounts?
Well, what we think SCA2 does, and this is really based on where SCA2 fits into other gene pathways that are involved in stress response. Now, what we think it does is to help shut off the stress response after a stress. So if we get stressed out, our bodies flood with cortisol, and this allows us to do what we need to do to get across the street or to wake up in the morning and get through that 9 a.m. meeting. You know, normal levels of stress are good, but then When it's done, this needs to shut off. And what we think SCA2 does in its normal function, if you have the right amount, we think that SCA2 helps to turn this off. So what we're finding is that if you've got lower levels of this, what we think is happening is that this isn't shutting off. And this is consistent with what's been shown in terms of dysregulated stress response in individuals who are suicidal.
I know this was a small study, but how clear were your results? How sharp a difference?
Yeah, you're right. It is a small study. And I do want to stress that, of course, this is not a clinical test that's currently available. But it represents a promising finding. And how promising was it? It was about 80% to 90% accurate, depending on the small samples that we looked at. So this really suggested that we might have the potential in the future, once we validate this with much larger cohorts of individuals, once we find out that we can test this reliably in larger groups, that we really may have a lot of potential to predict suicide.
80%. So you're saying when you look retrospectively at tissues of people who have committed suicide versus those who didn't, there's an 80% difference in the patterns you see of this gene expression.
Not exactly. What I mean is that we got 80% right in terms of individuals. When we broke the group of people into those who were thinking suicidal thoughts versus those that hadn't, the worst that our model performed in these small groups of individuals was getting 80% right. So we properly guessed 80% of those individuals who were thinking suicidal thoughts by modeling suicide based on this modification in the blood.
On WIPR Maryland Morning, I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Zachary Kaminsky, an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins Medicine. He's the lead researcher on a new study looking at a blood test that could possibly be used to predict suicide risk. And so how do you envision this test being used if it comes to be?
Yeah, so we've envisioned a few scenarios. One scenario that makes a lot of sense is to try to augment suicide screening that's already going on in various emergency room scenarios. Clinicians are screening for suicide risk, and a molecular test like this could really help to identify individuals that may be at higher risk, and this could help to tell a clinician how much they need to monitor someone, for example, if they're admitted to the hospital. The other scenario that we've envisioned is that it might be useful in the military. We know that the military experiences extreme stress. And one aspect that I haven't mentioned yet is that what we think this does is it confers a vulnerability to stress. So the military populations essentially are experiencing extreme stress and coming back from active duty and are at higher risk. And so identifying those individuals, we may be able to intervene.
Is there a way, as you understand through your work, more about some brains failing to control stress levels, the levels of stress hormones? Is there a way this could be used to create a medicine that would counteract that?
I mean, it's a great question. One of the things that we believe is that this probably isn't going to be the only gene that is important for suicide. It's a really interesting one. But currently, the technologies are not there to change a single gene. If this were, you know, a wonderful target with further research, if it was really that important, we don't have the technology to change the levels of the molecular signal for that particular gene, especially in an organ like the brain, which is difficult to reach. That being said, current medications may, in fact, change levels of these chemical modifications already. This needs a lot more study.
So that may be how they're working. We just don't know. We just don't know yet how it is that they work.
It's possible. Psychiatric research is finding that a lot of the medications that are used currently, various antidepressants, for example, do change these chemical marks. They don't just act to change signaling between neurons.
So this was a small study. There needs to be more study. What kind of timeline are we looking at before this is something that could actually be used?
Well, I mean, if this is really as promising as we think, and if we continue to validate it, you know, it's difficult to imagine, but it could be anywhere from 2 to 10 years. It really depends on what regulatory bodies want and also how well it performs, whether it's going to stand up to the test of time and to the test of working well in lots of individuals. So it could be soon, and it could be a long time. It's hard to guess.
What's the very next step?
Well, the next step for us is essentially we're going to collaborate with the principal investigators at the Army STARS group. Now, this is a group that has blood from military service members both before and after deployment. And we're basically going to ask the question, how well does this marker do? How well can we predict the suicidal behaviors that are inherent in that population? So we're going to get a good idea pretty soon of how well this is going to work.
I wish you luck.
Thank you very much.
Zachary Kaminsky. He's the lead researcher on a new study looking at a blood test that could be used to predict suicide risk. He's also assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins Medicine. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, remembering a civil rights journalist. Stay with us on 88.1.
Producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
Thanks, Nathan. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. George Collins, who died last week, started his career in journalism as a reporter at the Afro-American 64 years ago and rose to become its editor-in-chief. In 1968, he switched to broadcasting, joining WMAR-TV as an anchor. 20 years later, he started a public affairs show on WEAA, the NPR member station on the campus of Morgan State. Governor O'Malley yesterday called Collins, quote, a guardian of truth and justice, close quote. O'Malley's written statement said, in part, quote, George Collins embodied the best of journalism, offering insights and investigative reporting that changed the arc of history. George Collins exposed corruption, racism, and bigotry wherever he found it, reporting each of these stories with fairness and accuracy, end quote. Collins covered significant events in the civil rights movement, including the March on Washington and the funeral of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and closer to home, injustices in his community. Tom Hall spoke with Collins last October about the death in 1963 of Hattie Carroll, a 51-year-old African-American woman injured while working as a waitress at a Baltimore ball. Collins had covered that story of a guest at the party becoming impatient with Mrs. Carroll and striking her on the head with his cane. She died hours later. Collins told Tom.
And of course, it was old hat to those of us who had watched the rise and fall and the hesitation and the violence associated with racism in the country. So we regarded it as a typical case of a white man abusing a black woman for no reason, which over the years in this country had become a pattern.
George Collins was 88 when he died last week. His funeral will be tomorrow, 11 a.m., at New Shiloh Baptist Church on Monroe Street in Baltimore. A journalist who knew George Collins and worked with him is Charles Robinson, correspondent from Maryland Public Television, just back from chairing the National Association of Black Journalists Convention in Boston. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Sheila.
How did you first meet George?
Well, actually, I was reading him because I was delivering the Afro-American newspapers. And, and my patrons would say, if you want to sell this paper, read the paper. So I was reading all those little excerpts. But I got to know him personally as I became a professional and moved back to Baltimore. And probably one of the more storied stories about George is his effort to kind of break the idea that Maryland was not going to be accommodating to blacks as far as allowing blacks into restaurants. And black journalists are caught in a dual world. In other words, they're practicing journalism and they're also practicing activism. So George came up with this idea that maybe we can show the hypocrisy by posing as African potentates slash diplomats.
Yeah, this was during the Kennedy administration in 61. And the Kennedy administration was worried about black diplomats moving from Washington to the United Nations and not being treated well along U.S. Route 40 in Baltimore County and Harford County.
So the idea was real simple. George and a couple of his colleagues at the Afro said, well, let's see how it works and see if it really works. So they had found some African garb, but to make it work, they needed a limo. So they went to a local funeral home and asked, can we borrow the limo? And they could say, we're going to get a limo driver. We're going to make it look real. And of course, you know, they had all the prerequisite stuff and they walked in. And of course, the manager said, oh, please come have a seat, have dinner on it. And it was the Double T Diner that's on Route 40 and Rolling Road. And they sat there and had dinner and they got back in the car. And George said they had the biggest laugh, but they said, this is a much bigger story. And that begins to break down. The laws in the state about not being able to serve blacks in restaurants.
And I think of it this week when there's all these dozens of heads of African heads of states in Washington and all these limousines and motorcade. And I think of George Collins. You interviewed him recently.
Yes, I did. It was on the during the dedication of the Martin Luther King Memorial in Washington, D.C. And what George told me about that was he said, Charles, people don't know that that march was not really as popular as people thought it was. People thought people were going to burn down the city of Washington. All these blacks coming. They didn't know whites were coming, but they knew we're going to have all these black folks coming to D.C. My God, shut the liquor stores. That was the first edict that came down. Because remember, there's no home rule in D.C. at this point. It's being run by Congress. And George, of course, got on a bus with patrons from here. In those days, you know, African-Americans of a certain age will remind you, your mama always gave you a chicken sandwich on a piece of white bread and a brown bag and a soda. That was your meal for the day.
Because you couldn't count on being able to buy.
You were not going to be able to go into a restaurant, and that was it. But let me also talk about George and his television career, because it kind of mirrors mine to a certain extent. You know, most people around in this city know you've seen African Americans on television. In fact, he and another guy by the name of Wiley Daniels kind of broke that color barrier in television here. But you can go around this country, and very few people will see people. I can tell you, I saw both of them and had the gumption to think, you know what? I can do this. And went to a school in the Capital Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia. And I had white professors look at me, why do you think you can do this? And that was what you need. And I always remind folk, you know, male, female, others, you emulate what you think is the best. And so people see you and they think, I think I can do this. And there's some young lady, young man somewhere who's listening to us and saying, you know what? I think I can do this. And that's really the great legacy of George Collins.
Wow. You mentioned, we have just a minute or so left, but you mentioned the sort of dual responsibility he had reporting and being accurate, but also being activist.
Yeah. And
did he talk to you about that?
He said, you know, there's a guy named Moses Newsom, and they were on the roads going through the Deep South. The Afro would send their correspondents literally to cover the news wherever it was. And the thing is that when there's nobody there and you're there by yourself and you're facing, you know, people taunting you, calling you names, it changes your perspective. I mean, it really does, because you realize, of course, you become a part of the story, but you must try and stay objective. But you've got to kind of have that edge to say, not so much it's wrong, but explain why it's wrong. And I think that's part of the legacy of George Collins.
Part of what your generation learned from him.
Absolutely. I'm in the third generation of African-American journalists. He was kind of in the second. The first one was they found all these black journalists. They were writing for black newspapers. And when the riots happened here in 68, then they said, well, let's find some people on television. So they go look at the black newspapers. And that's where they got most of their reporters. And
that's where they got George Collins. I really appreciate your coming in to talk to us, Charles.
Thank you so very much for talking about my friend.
Thank you. Charles Robinson, correspondent for Maryland Public Television. George Collins' wake is this afternoon, 3 to 8 p.m. at Estep Brothers Funeral Services on Utah Place in Baltimore. Celebration service will take place tomorrow, 11 a.m. at the new Shiloh Baptist Church in West Baltimore. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. And now a follow-up to our conversation with the Baltimore Sun's arbiter of language and writer of the blog You Don't Say. When John McIntyre visited us a week ago, we discussed whether it's more accurate to call the young people crossing the southern U.S. border immigrants or refugees. And then McIntyre told me why one of his blog posts on the topic was headlined, "It Turns Out That I Was Wrong."
I said that it was improper to call these children criminals, because immigration law is civil law, not criminal law. And it turns out I was wrong. There is a distinction. When people overstay their visas, for example, that becomes a matter of civil law, and it's handled through the Immigration and Naturalization Agency. Crossing the border without permission, crossing the border illegally, is in fact a criminal act in the U.S. Code. And so I had to publish a correction and an apology.
That caught the ears of the staff at Catholic Charities Esperanza Center in Fells Point, who called to say McIntyre was more right the first time than in his correction. Esperanza Center's managing attorney, Adonia Simpson, said most of the children crossing the border are not violating criminal law because the criminal code must be read in conjunction with case law and several other federal laws that apply to children. Specifically, Simpson told us, the Federal Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Act establishes that a juvenile adjudication is not a conviction of a crime, but a determination of the status of the offender. We have more details about these laws on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on Maryland Morning, send us an email to mdmorning@wypr.org or phone us at 410-881-3162. Again, 410-881-3162. I'm Sheila Cass. After a break on Maryland Morning, a reporter's novel about a reporter's quest. Stay tuned to 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. The Baltimore-based author Paul Valentine is a former reporter for The Washington Post. He's just published his third novel, which takes place in rural North Carolina, 2 years after the death of Martin Luther King Jr. The protagonist, Arliss Morrow, is a white newspaper reporter who is searching for a black childhood friend he hasn't seen for 30 years. Along the way, he encounters a cast of pretty eccentric characters, and he uncovers disturbing facts about his family's past. It's a book about the large issues of race and class in the context of a small town in the American South. It's called The Road to Goshen Shoals, and Paul Valentine joins me in the studio. It's great to meet you.
Good to see you.
So the setting of this book is almost a character in itself. Tell us about Goshen Shoals and the area in which this book takes place.
It's a small, isolated, bleak county in the central part of North Carolina called the Piedmont, and it has traditionally been that parts of the Piedmont have traditionally been very poor. And this book, a story set in 1970 when the poverty was still much more extensive than it is today.
And it was a mixed community, black and white?
Yes, it was mixed, although it was at least the county that I'm describing in the novel, which is a fictitious county, is predominantly white. It has a small black population, and there's a historical reason for that. That is that it was so soil there was so poor that farming was not particularly beneficial, and so there were no large plantations which would have lots of slaves. And so the blacks who do live in this fictitious county as of today are not so much the blacks from the Civil War, pre-Civil War time, but post-Civil War who migrated there and lived on small plots of land scattered through the county.
Mm-hmm. So in this rural environment, if agriculture isn't the main thing, the main occupation, what is? How do folks make a living?
Well, it's hard scrabble. They do the best they can, small businesses, small jobs, hiring out to the town, whatever jobs are available in the town to keep the infrastructure of the town going. And it's people move around a great deal from one job to another. There's a great deal of instability.
So your main protagonist, like yourself, is a newspaper reporter. He's in his early to mid-30s. Tell us a little bit about Arliss Morrow.
Yeah, Arliss Morrow is a character I've created. I wouldn't say it's autobiographical, but he is certainly a young white reporter of what would, back in the 1970s, would have been called the New South. He was young enough to have gone, or old enough to have gone through a considerable period of official legal racial segregation, and then after that came the Civil Rights Movement and the passage of various civil rights laws, which brought an end to formal or legal segregation. And he was part of that whole transition and is trying to figure it out, its impact and on both white people and black people in the years after the major civil rights legislation.
So he grew up in this county in which the novel takes place, but he's returning. He has since left home and has been living in the big city.
Exactly. He makes it out of this bleak, remote county by going to the University of North Carolina. And from there, with a degree, he's able to get a job with a newspaper in the state's capital of Raleigh. And then he returns to the county, not permanently. He is had to return because his mother died, and on her deathbed, she had asked him to try to find a black kid that Arliss had known when he and the kid were both about 5 or 6 years old, that is to say before they went off to their separate public schools. And in the intervening 30 years, the dying mother, for her own reasons that are not clear to Arliss or to anyone else, wants Arliss to find him and see what's happened to him in the intervening 30 years.
So his character as a child was named Jesse. His name changes by the time we finally meet him. Most of the book is spent in searching for him.
Yeah.
And so he's motivated. Arliss is motivated by his mom and her curiosity, but he's also got some questions of his own, doesn't he?
He certainly does have questions of his own, and those questions are largely informed by the changes in the civil rights laws, or the changes brought on by the civil rights laws, because it's essentially changed the relationship between blacks and whites. Traditionally, you know, the relationship was one where the white power structure dictated the relationship, and with the new laws, that old structure was starting to disintegrate, and a new, more equitable arrangement was developing. But it was still very much in formation in 1970.
I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Paul Valentine. His new book is called The Road to Goshen Shoals. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast on 88.1. Talk a little bit about the impact of the death of Dr. King in the rural South. not in the cities. We know that rioting broke out almost immediately in the large cities in America. But you're talking about 1970, rural North Carolina. The Civil Rights Act is now 5 years old, and then Dr. King is murdered in 1968. There was a different reaction in the rural parts of the country than there was in the cities to some extent.
Yeah, I would say so. In the first place, because the population itself is much more dispersed and sparse, the reaction was muted. The black population was so scattered that it didn't have the sense of unity in large numbers that formed in the cities, in the urban centers. And the white population had differing reactions, ranging from honest sadness at the death of Dr. King to one of general gladness. I mean, it was a tremendous range, and there were still, even in 1970, fragments of the old Ku Klux Klan structure and neo-Nazi organizations which saw this as an opportunity to rally more support for them. And that was sort of more the atmosphere in the rural areas of the South.
Are you yourself a son of the South? I'm wondering how you put yourself in the mind of, African Americans at that time period in that that rural setting.
I am a son of the South in the sense that I was literally born in central North Carolina. However, as a quirk there, because my parents were not from North Carolina. They were outliers. My mother was from Brooklyn, and my father was from New York State, and they both, after they were married, they moved to Detroit, where my father was an engineer for Ford Motor Company. He gets laid off in the Depression years and is promised a job in North Carolina by one of his brothers, so he moves to North Carolina with his wife, and who was then pregnant with me in the mid-1930s. And so I was born in small town North Carolina essentially as an outsider, and brought up with that, seeing the South through that lens, which is very different from being a more typical son of the South.
Sure. Did you have any misgivings or any nervousness, I suppose I'd call it, about, writing black characters as a white guy?
Indeed, I did. I was never 100% confident that I was reflecting or giving a correct or authentic reflection of black thinking, of black decision-making, and black characterizations in general. I wrote the book more or less on my own without sort of consulting with any other, black colleagues in my line of work. But after I finished it, I did send it around to a couple of long trusted black friends of mine who read it. And I was very relieved that they told me that it did read to them as an authentic story and correctly reflected the very, very ambiguous and complex thinking of both white people and black people. And that complexity was especially noticeable when the blacks and whites are talking to each other.
Sure. This is a self-published book.
Yes.
And I wonder, is that a purposeful decision on yours? Did you send it to agents and to publishers? Did you make the decision on your own to self-publish?
It's a long, tangled history, and to make that story a short one. My first book, which I published or had published in 1989, was published in the typical fashion through a bricks-and-mortar publishing company in New York. And then I wrote a second novel two or three years after that. And my editor in New York didn't like it. We had an amicable parting of the ways, but I lost my contacts with the sort of publishing world and the literary agency world, and with the loss of that, and also with the more recent arrival of self-publishing and the diminishing of traditional publishing houses in New York and elsewhere. self-publishing became...
The moment was right, yeah. Became
the option.
Of course, when you do this without an editor, of course, Frank DeFord, I always loved his comment about editors. I mean, he's, you know, on National Public Radio, but wrote for years for Sports Illustrated and many other publications. He said every editor should have a pimp for a brother so he'd had someone to look up to. You know, he was not a fan of editors. But you're doing this without an editor, and that's a, that's a very different experience for a writer, writing a whole, you know...
It is a very different experience. However, that difference is diminished slightly by the fact that I had 35, 38 years in the journalistic world as a reporter, where my work was closely edited every day. And I was used to going through the through the whole process of having my whatever I was writing vetted very carefully for all kinds of entirely reasonable, proper reasons, and so I'm accustomed to being edited, and I know what kinds of edits to do. In fact, you sort of pick up the habits as you go along. Now, I mean, there's sort of two levels of editing. One is your grammar, your syntax, your punctuation, the mechanics of editing. And the other one is the more cerebral, big brush, broad brush sort of approach to storytelling, and I got a very good dose of the first and a fairly good dose of the second.
What was your beat at the Post?
I covered law enforcement, cops, courts, prisons, law enforcement policy, that kind of thing was my specialty. And I had other – we all did general assignment, but those are my specialties.
Yeah, well, a couple of cops in this book, but it's interesting that this is somewhat a departure from that professional endeavor.
Indeed,
that's for sure.
Indeed.
Well, Paul Valentine, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Paul Valentine, his latest book is called The Road to Goshen Shoals. He'll be speaking about the book tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Govens branch of the Enoch Pratt Library. We'll have a link to more information on our website. Come on over to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Friday on the program, I'll take a tour of the new exhibit at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture with its director, Dr. Skip Saunders, and the beatboxer Shodake, who has created audio installations as part of that exhibition. Hope you can join us Friday morning on Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. Come to our website to learn more about what you've heard on our show or catch something you've missed. Again, the address is WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Our director and engineer is Nathan Sterner. We've got production help from Brandon Block, Alexander Kennedy, and Justina Latimer. For Sheila Cast, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.